Do what thou wilt should be the whole of the law. Welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast, the podcast dedicated to the exploration of Thelema, Aleister Crowley, the New Eon, and the occult. My name is John Crow, and I'm the host of the show. Before we get into this show, I want to thank everyone who left comments on the website, emailed, and also posted to other forums about the previous podcasts. In particular, I appreciate the comments regarding the interview with Tony Stansfield Jones. I'm glad to know that others are interested in these kind of historical interviews. I will endeavor to bring more of this material to the show when I can. Today's show consists of three short interviews. In the previous four podcasts, I have spent a good deal of time regarding the Ordo Templi Orientis. This is not surprising, as it is the largest and most predominant organization in the Thelemic community. However, that does not mean it will be the sole focus of the interviews. This current podcast is an example of that. On today's show, I will be interviewing the members of two different organizations that are serving the Thelemic and occult communities. The first is an interview with Joseph Amara from Astrum Sophia. I will also be interviewing Reginald Freeman of the Ecclesia Gnostica Catholica Hermetica. Both of these organizations serve members of the occult and Thelemic communities in different capacities. It is my hope that these brief interviews will help those whose paths are in alignment with these groups to find them and do their will. The last interview today will be with Keith 418, as we discuss some studies and information that could help the Thelemic community to better understand itself, its motivations, and how it relates to society in general. The music on today's podcast is from the Ambient Temple of Imagination. The opening was from the first part of their song, Beat Regeneration, and the closing song is going to be Blood Moon, Mother Goddess. Before we get into the interviews, I want to take a moment and talk briefly about the Book of the Law, Liberal Valesius. By 1904, when Crowley received Liberal, he was coming from a well-read background of a variety of books, especially the Bible. This is important to consider when reading the Book of the Law. I point this out because those who are less familiar with the Bible might find certain passages from the Bible and Liberal to be surprisingly similar. I'll give two examples to whet your appetite. I would hope this would encourage people to take some time and look deeper into the verses of Liberal, because they contain a vast amount of meaning. The first example is astonishingly almost a direct quote from the Apocalypse of John, also known as Revelation. In Liberal, we read in chapter 2, verse 57, "He that is righteous shall be righteous still, and he that is filthy shall be filthy still." In chapter 22, verse 11 of Revelation, we read, "He that is unjust, let him be unjust still. He that is filthy, let him be filthy still. He that is righteous, let him be righteous still. And he that is holy, let him be holy still." I'm sure this comes as a surprise to many listeners. In addition, we find three separate warnings in Liberal about not changing even the style of a letter. These three warnings are in chapter 136. "My scribe Ankof Nakansu, the priest of princes, shall not in one letter change this book, but lest there be folly." Chapter 1, verse 54, "Change not so much as a style of the letter, for behold, thou, O prophet, shall not behold all these mysteries hidden therein." And in chapter 2, verse 54, "The stops as thou wilt, the letters, change them not in style or value." Similarly, the Bible has warnings about changing the text too. In Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 2, "Ye shall not add unto the word which I command you, neither shall ye diminish aught from it." Also in Revelation chapter 22, verse 18, "For I testify unto every man that heareth the words of the prophecy of this book, if any man shall add unto these things, God shall add unto him the plagues that are written in this book." One may wonder why these warnings were put in there in the first place. The reason is simple. The easiest way to interject one's opinion is to insert them into the scriptures and have the religious figures present them as points of view of their own. This was very common during the times of scribe transcription. Many so-called canonical scriptures have been found to be inserted later while copies were being transcribed. This was so common that most scholars no longer attribute many of the letters of Paul to him. This is all very well and good, but now that books are typeset, printed, and photocopied, this is no longer an issue, right? In general, yes, but there are some things to consider. First, people should know that Crowley did make a number of changes to the text of Liberal. I'm not the one to say that this is right or wrong. He was the prophet, after all. Yet, it is an interesting thing to note. For instance, in chapter 1, verse 30, we read, "This is the creation of the world, that the pain of division is as nothing, and the joy of dissolution all." In the handwritten manuscript is a different word crossed out and division written over it. In Red Flame number 8, Jerry Cornelius does an examination of the various versions of Liber All printed during Crowley's life and the original manuscript. He asserts that the original word was disunion and was changed by Crowley. When examining Liber All, we see corrections like the changing of words from there, T-H-E-R-E, to there, T-H-E-I-R, or vice versa. Other misspellings are corrected, and anyone doing any kind of analysis will see the various punctuations used are all varying throughout the editions. Again, this is not to say Crowley was wrong for making these changes, and certainly some of the changes are typographical errors, such as a few ands, A-N, becoming ands, A-N-D, in one version. Nevertheless, this kind of investigation and scholarship is important. By doing these investigations, we learn more about Thelema, its origins, and probably most important, not make these same mistakes today. I encourage anyone listening to the podcast and interested in textual analysis to get a copy of Red Flame No. 8 by Jerry Cornelius. I also want to note that there are other sources of information and research about Liber All, including concordances and commentaries. All of these works are wonderful tools to delve deeper into the text of Liber All and discover more about the hidden meaning of this phenomenal text. Next, we'll hear from Joseph Amara about Astrum Sophia. This group is a chartered offshoot of the organization Arum Solis. While not Thelemic, they do have a lot of occult knowledge to offer their students. This may seem odd on a show about Thelema, but as the tagline says, this show is also about the occult, so I felt their inclusion appropriate. I hope you find the interview interesting.
We have on the phone with us Joseph A. Amara from Ordo Astrum Sophia, who's going to tell us a bit about the organization and its relationship to Thelema. Are you there, Joseph?
I am. I'm here, John.
Well, let's first start with the history of the Ordo Astrum Sophia and its relationship to the parent organization or where it came from, Arum Solis. And if you could start from the Arum Solis side and talk about where it derived from, and where it is now.
You bet. Okay. Aurum Solis, or the Order of the Sacred Word, was founded in 1897, and it was founded out of an antiquarian society, which, you know, as your listeners probably know, antiquarian societies were very popular in the 19th century in terms of studying old pieces, kind of a hold-on from the Renaissance. And it is a Aurum Solis was a ceremonial magic order based on Hermeticism and a tradition called the Ogdoadic tradition. And basically, in the early part of this millennia, the 2000s, the Aurum Solis started to expand again. It's always been a pretty small order, usually consisting of under about 30 or 40 people. And long about the year 2000, Aurum Solis became interested in getting in new members. And out here in North America, one of the highest initiates, a man by the name of William Stoltz, started up the Aurum Solis, and it was so popular and received so many initiates that it kind of scared the actual Aurum Solis order. And it ended up with it being a little bit bigger than they felt like they wanted to administer. And so what they did at that point was, and this is long about 2002, they decided to break off the North American bodies of Aurum Solis and give them a charter of succession, which was a recognition that all those bodies were initiated into the tradition, but the charter of succession allowed us to form our own order as a full successor from Ordem Solis, and that's what became the Astrum Sophia,
okay,
which has now been functioning for a couple, well, going on 3 years here in North America.
So is the Astrum Sophia only within the United States, or is it United States and Canada, or other parts?
No, actually, we are a worldwide order, though obviously because of the roots I just explained, most of our initiates are still in North America, though we do have initiates in France, Canada, Right now we have one of our initiates in Iraq, and we have people really all over the world. There's also several who are still in England. However, I would say we're pretty much North American-focused, at least in terms of, you know, you do have to travel to one of our bodies in order to be initiated, and right now all of our functioning bodies are in North America.
Now, I also noticed in your documentation you have the difference between a commandery and a citadel. Can you touch on that for a moment?
Sure. In general, they're basically just a difference of size. Where we have initiates scattered all around the world, we allow them to create citadels, which are basically initial groups, discussion groups about the tradition, where people can get together and practice some rites. But the real difference between a commandery and a citadel involves initiating. Commanderies can actually initiate. Citadels are more like study groups.
Okay. The documentation also says that the system is a three-degree system, first hall, second hall, third hall. Can
Correct.
You explain that some?
Yes. Well, basically, like many different pieces that, you know, coming off the Hermetic tradition, most of them operate in three halls. The first hall is a general welcoming into the current, and we begin education at that point. Previous to third hall, there's a novice level as well, in which folks learn about the tradition and the basic pieces. Starting with second hall, an initiate is actually incorporated into the corporate body of the order, where they're considered to be, you know, contributing as much to the order as, you know, can be recognized. It's also at second hall that members can begin to take an administrative role in the order. And then third hall is roughly equivalent to a Golden Dawn Adeptus Minor degree, or 5=6. That's a recognition that basically you've been trained as a magician in the system, and it's a recognition of kind of an Adeptus Minor sort of level, where the work that you do from third hall and on is basically an individual process of self-development, and you've recognized and been passed through the system, basically.
Okay. If somebody was a Thelemite, what is the relationship between Thelema and the what's being taught in the Astrum Sophia?
Well, there's an enormous amount of similarities. Both the Thelemic system and the Astrum Sophia system, which can be called Ogdoadic, draw their roots from the Hermetic tradition. And in that way, there's an awful lot of similarity. Basically, the principal goal of the magician being initially to contact their divine genius, or holy guardian angel in Thelemic terms, and then, you know, receive further instruction from that angel in terms of where their magical system goes next. The principal difference is that the Thelemic system is based upon Rosicrucianism, whereas the Astrum Sophia system is based upon the Ogdoadic tradition. And it's a little bit different take on Hermeticism, with the Rosicrucian system, you know, of course, being built around the myth of Christian Rosenkreutz and a lot of German pieces, the Famas, out of the 14th century, whereas the Ogdoadic tradition harkens much more back to the Byzantium, and coming through the writings of the Italian Renaissance philosophers like Facchino and Bruno. So it's just a little bit different take on the tradition, but the two traditions are pretty compatible in that there are three principal deities that they work with. Of course, in the Thelemic system, it's Nuit, Hadit, and Rahur Kuit. In the Ogdoadic tradition, it's Lukathea, who's the white goddess, Milana Theos, who's the dark god, and then the Agatha Daimon, which is, you know, both the combination of those two and the predecessor that gives birth to those two. But really, it's pretty easy to map those deities to each other in terms of Nuit being compatible with Lukathea, Hadit being compatible with Milana Theos, and Rahur Kuit being compatible with the concept of the Agatha Daimon. So really, when it comes to actually using the rites, it's pretty easy to interchange the two, and they're comfortable philosophically with each other.
In your personal practices, how have the two worked together?
Well, the Thelemic system, the current in general, it has that great ability to bring up enthusiasm and, you know, inflaming oneself in prayer, as it were, whereas the Ogdoadic system tends to be very well-founded in Hermetic philosophy. And so the two offer quite a bit of strength to either system, whereas sometimes Crowley is pretty, let's say, non-specific in his instructions, and you have to fill in a lot of the gaps. The Ogdoadic tradition almost overcomes itself with specificity. And so the two work in pretty good places there. Where there are holes in either of the systems, they seem to complement each other pretty well.
The relationship between the teacher and student, is that more attuned to an OTO type structure where it's done in a social environment, or is it closer to the AA?
No, not at all. The Ogdoadic tradition harkens much more back to the traditional Hermetic system, similar more to the AA in Thelema, I'd say. Though, whereas in the AA, that's really the only structure between student and teacher. There is a fraternal aspect where the various halls, you know, gather together in friendship and comity and things along those lines. The real instruction takes place through a student-to-teacher relationship. When somebody joins the Astrum Sophia, they're assigned a mentor. And any questions they have of any regard, whether that's a magical question or a question regarding how the order works, the administration, or anything like that, they can always address those questions to a mentor. And if that mentor then gets a question which is beyond them, they themselves have a mentor which can pass the instruction all the way up. And so in that way, it's kind of a question-answering system that's been built into the order. And, of course, the most valuable things that anyone studying magic can find in terms of a social event is the right questions. So that's kind of a way that the order has institutionalized asking questions.
You said that most of the commanderies or all of the commanderies are currently within the United States. Where are the actual commanderies located?
Well, our Grand Commandery, which is the Commandery of the Winged Serpent, is in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And there is a second commandery, the Commandery of the Green Lion, which operates out of California. And those are the only two commanderies that are functional right now. We do have a citadel in Toronto, Canada, the Citadel of the Phoenix. And there is a citadel, though I'm not sure of its exact status at the moment, in Seattle as well. And we do also have a citadel in France, but that really consists of just two of our initiates at the moment who study together. But any one of those citadels could very shortly turn into a commandery. We've only been operating again here recently. There was a brief period of time where we brought down Astrum Sophia and rejoined with the Aurum Solis, our mother order, for a moment. But we spent about a year there, and a number of our commanderies and citadels haven't made the switch back to Astrum Sophia since we discontinued that relationship.
Okay, now you said there was one in California. What city or near what large city?
You know, I wish I had that information for you. I'm not sure if the Commandery of the Green Lion has an operating address at the moment.
Okay.
As I say, there's been a lot of change in the past year or so, and I believe that it's kind of moved around a little bit. But anybody who's interested in California can always contact the Order, and we can get you in contact with the Commander.
How should the any person interested, how should they contact?
Well, one of the best ways is to hit the website of the Commandery of the Winged Serpent, which they can get to with the URL ogdoadic.com, and you spell that O-G-D-O-A-D-I-C ogdoadic.com. And also, of course, typing Ogdoadic into Google will get you a number of different sites that, follow the Ogdoadic tradition.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate you being on the show and letting people know about your group and what you're doing. And I'm sure if anybody has any question, they'll contact you through
you
the website.
Bet. Thank you, John. I appreciate you letting folks know.
Thanks. I'll talk to you later.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Many Thelemites debate whether Thelema is a religion or a philosophy. The word religion itself seems to have a significant stigma for many. Yet religion of some kind is still very vital to many practitioners. The next organization is a Gnostic Hermetic church that has incorporated the teachings of Thelema within their liturgy. As a result, it offers the option for Thelemites looking for an ecclesiastical type of religion to be experienced within a Thelemic context. This has similarities to the EGC within the OTO, but the Ecclesia Gnostica Catholica Hermetica is a completely autonomous organization with no initiatory affiliation. Let's hear more from one of the church's bishops, Reginald Freeman.
We have on the phone with us Reginald Freeman from the Ecclesia Gnostica Catholica Hermetica, or the Gnostic Catholic Church, or the Hermetic Gnostic Catholic Church. How are you doing, Reginald?
Oh, fine, John. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
We're very glad to have you here. Can you first start off by telling us about the EGCH and how it got started, where it's located, and the practices that it performs?
Sure. Well, the EGCH began as a parish of another Gnostic church, which goes by the French Église Gnostique Catholique Apostolique, a jurisdiction headed by Bishop Robert Coquinas. The EGCH, St. Michael's Parish of the EGCA started in Kenosha, Wisconsin in September of 2000, and in 2001, the clergy of the parish had been developing new liturgies which, strictly speaking, were really outside of the doctrine of our parent Gnostic church. And so from about July of 2001, we ceased operating as a parish of our parent church and continued operating under the name of Ecclesia Gnostica Catholica Hermetica.
Okay. And what practices or liturgies, and what is the basis of the liturgies that you operate in?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that we consider the EGCH first and foremost to be a Gnostic church. We have elements of various traditions, which include the apostolic tradition, the Thelemic tradition, Islamic or more particularly Quranic traditions, Hermetic traditions, as well as traditional or ancient Gnostic traditions. And these are reflected in the five holy books of the church, which are the Bible, the Quran, the Corpus Hermeticum, the Nag Hammadi Library, and Libra Valdigis, the Book of the Law.
Okay. Are you saying that Thelema is very much a part of the EGCH?
Absolutely. It's been very important to us from the beginning, and I would say has played a very integral part in the development of the church, in the development of our rites, our liturgies, and our doctrine. It's not always, I guess you could say, explicit within the rite. Sometimes it is, and sometimes it's not. But we believe that the spirit of Thelema permeates the church and permeates our intentions for the church, which could be summed up in helping others and helping ourselves to not only discover our true will, but also, more importantly, to do that will and to make that will known in our lives, in our communities, in our families.
Now, the EGCH is also a member of the North American College of Gnostic Bishops.
Yes, EGCH was one of five founding jurisdictions of the North American College of Gnostic Bishops. The NACGB was founded by the EGCH along with the Apostolic Johannite Church, the Apostolic Church of the Third Age, which is a Joachimite theology, l'Église Gnostique Catholique Apostolique, Catholicat de la Croix de Rose, which is an autocephalous jurisdiction of the Église Gnostique Catholique Apostolique, and the Ecclesia Gnostica Pravis. Since that time, since the founding of the NACGB, we have been joined by the Thomasine Church and its patriarch Mar Didymus, the Polemic Gnostic Church of Alexandria with its primate Paul Apollonius, and more recently the Gnostic Church of Christianopolis, headed by Bishop John Cole.
You said that Thelema is an integral part of the liturgy, sometimes directly, indirectly. Do most of the members of the church consider themselves Thelemites?
I would say so. It's not a doctrine that we necessarily enforce. In other words, if someone joins the church, we do not make them swear any oaths to Thelema. We do not insist that they consider themselves Thelemites. But given our approach to the work, I would think that anyone that didn't consider themselves a Thelemite, or at least anyone who had any serious issues with Thelema, would probably not be attracted to our church to begin with, particularly because the Book of the Law is one of our five holy books.
Okay. Now, the name of the church is the EGCH, and that has some similarities with the EGC, which is part of the OTO. Is there any relationship between the EGC and the EGCH?
There is no direct relationship. This has been an occasional issue for us, but not much once people start looking into the church and our practices and our rites. But because of the similarity in name, it does occasionally come up. We didn't derive from the EGC, nor are we any sort of offshoot or alternative to the EGC. We are a completely distinct body with a distinct doctrine. The similarity in the names largely comes from the fact that both bodies have derived from the French Gnostic movement started by Jules Doisnel, Fabre Talapot, and others of the late 19th and early 20th century, and the Église Gnostique that came out of that movement, and then later by Jean Brocaud's reformation of that church, which became known as both Église Gnostique Catholique as well as the Église Gnostique Universelle. And it's been tradition since that time for derivatives or the offspring of those bodies to include the name Église Gnostique or Ecclesia Gnostica or simply the English Gnostic Church as part of their title, in a way to designate that we are a continuance of this tradition.
Okay. Has the church made any kind of statement about a relationship between Thelema, the Gnostic Catholic Church, the OTO, or any official statement so that if anybody is confused or has concerns?
Yes, as a matter of fact, we have. We have a statement that's available on the website, which unfortunately is down for maintenance right now. We're hoping to have that back up within a day or two.
Perhaps you can give me a different link that I can link to it on the Thelema Coast to Coast website for people to see.
Absolutely, absolutely. And what this statement basically says is, well, the first part of it is essentially what I just told you, explaining why the churches have a similar name, as well as other Gnostic churches in the broader community. And it makes it very clear that we have no official relationship to the EGC, But it also makes it clear that the EGCH does hold the Book of the Law to be among her holy books, and also recognizes the Master Therion among her saints and prophets. I would say that the bishops of the EGCH interpret the Law of Thelema as meaning on a basic level, in a very general sense, that within each individual resides a true will, or a latent consummate self, which must be both discovered and realized. And I'd like to put an emphasis on the realized. And we are also an apostolic church. We hold that the supreme attainment is possible through an intimate conversation, attunement, and union with the mediator. We call the Christ, or Logos, sometimes Logos of the Eternal Aeon. And we believe that the Logos is one and has manifested throughout history in different times and different places to different people according to the needs of the community.
If people wanted to contact the church, it's physically located in, or the parish is located in Wisconsin, is that correct?
Well, the mother parish is located in Wisconsin. There are also parishes currently operating in Anchorage, Alaska, Fort Myers, Florida, Virginia Beach, Virginia, and Berkeley, California.
Okay. And if somebody wanted to contact the church, what website would they go to?
They would go to www.egch.org.
And or if they wanted to email, could they email you directly?
They can email me directly, and I'll provide you with a link for that. Also, they can email the Sylvan Triad, which is the governing body of the church, at sylvan.triad@egch.org.
Okay, that's probably the better one for people to contact in general.
For general information, yes, that would be the best.
Then that's the one I'll put on the website. Well, I really appreciate you being on Thelema Coast to Coast, and I'm glad to hear about the work that the church is doing, and I hope the brief interview that we've done will make it available to people who are interested in following this path as Thelemites. So thank you for being on the show.
Well, I certainly appreciate you having me on, John, and I really appreciate the work that you've been doing. I've found it entertaining, enlightening, and it's really caused me to contemplate a lot of the issues that you've brought forth, and I think that that is your intention, and I think that that's really a great service to the community, and I hope it continues to prosper.
Well, thank you for your kind words, and I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, take care.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
Our last interview is with Keith 418. Within the last few weeks, the research of Lawrence Iannacone has surfaced through the sharp eyes and referral of an OTO brother in Massachusetts. Iannacone is an economist that has used economic models to explain why people would actively choose to associate with organizations and religions when they are clearly in conflict with the norms of society. This material is really interesting and gives us a viable model to explore the characteristics of the Thelemic community and the organizations within it. This analysis will help bring to light characteristics that could help organizational leaders identify and change emergent patterns. I cannot stress enough how useful these kinds of working models are. They hardly answer all the questions or cover all scenarios, but they do help us get closer to having a more meaningful understanding of the patterns within our organizations. On the Thelema Coast to Coast website, I'll have links to the short bio of Iannacone and also a list of his essays and articles. Now let's hear Keith talk about this fascinating subject more.
Keith, welcome to Thelema Coast to Coast. How are you?
I'm doing great, John. Thanks for having me.
What has been on your mind lately?
Well, I think we're all really fascinated with the Iannacone material, the Lawrence Iannacone writings on looking at rational choice and sex in churches. I think it's sort of consumed a certain number of people looking at the Thelema community, looking at various organizations, and I think most of us will agree that there's a lot of really rich material there, and that Iannacone's work really goes a long way towards answering certain questions that we've had, and I think that's why it's been very valuable.
Can you give a brief summary of the model that he's working with that all of his work builds on?
Well, he basically looks at the idea of rational choice in religion, and most economists and sociologists have had a hard time doing this in the past because in rational choice, you know, people make decisions economic decisions based on certain criteria, and none of those criteria seem to work, or did seem to work, in a religious setting. People make sacrifices and commitments that seem irrational and go against the idea of rational choice. And what Inikon does, and it's very remarkable, is that he sort of twists that issue around and says, no, you know, there are really rational reasons for the choices people make in religious communities, and they need to be looked at in a rational choice model. So he applies certain economic ideas to religious choice and the religious market, so to speak, in a deregulated religious community where there isn't one state religion and where there's competition among various religious groups. He looks at it as, in a market sense, and sees why people are making the choices they do in terms of their religious commitments and values. And I think this is fascinating, and it answers, you know, as I said, a lot of questions that we've had about the Thelemic organizations and how they sort of fit into this model and why they behave the way they do and why they make the decisions that they do. And I just think that, you know, it's not a complete picture, but it gives us a lot of ways to look at various problems and questions that we've had about these issues in the past.
The rational choice model also sets up not a complete dichotomy, but does set up two extremes of a bell curve. On one side, a church that's very liberal and very close to society, and on the other side, a sect that is in a lot of tension with society.
Right. That's one way of defining the difference between sect and church.
Where do you think Thelema falls in that order, from church to sect within that curve?
Well, we have to ask ourselves, Thelema in what context? If we look at the OTO as a religious organization, for example, and we can debate whether it really is or not, and we can avoid that debate by just saying it's a spiritual organization or an organization concerned with metaphysics or magic, I think those terms are still appropriate, then we can say, is it a sect or is it a church? Well, we have to ask, well, is it a sect in the way Crowley described it, or is it a way in which it's currently being approached by modern Thelemites? And I think that Crowley very much designed it as a sect. Not in every way that Inikon describes, but in very significant ways, with a lot of tension between it and normative society. And I think that the modern OTO, starting in the 90s, has more or less rejected the sect approach and is trying instead to form the organization into what, you know, Inikon would look at as more of a church.
What are the characteristics of a sect?
Well, one of the characteristics is tension with the larger community. And, you know, extreme sects are like the community in Waco, or, you know, maybe like the Moonies or the Krishnas, are, you know, organizations with self-discipline, with seemingly irrational or very hard to meet sorts of disciplines or structures. And churches, you know, on the other hand, don't really have any conflict with mainstream society, you know, more or less move towards secular humanism and aren't distinguished by any kind of tension with the larger social order, whereas sects tend to have that sort of tension going on, and more discipline and more, you know, sort of extreme behavior is associated with them. And what Inikon says, and I think this is one of the most significant things, is that there are really good reasons for the severe sorts of disciplines that people subject themselves to when they enter sects. And one of the best reasons is that those disciplines screen away half-hearted people and freeloaders and make the experience within that community more intense and more valuable. So it's basically like applying to Harvard or Yale, where you're surrounded by other very dedicated, very committed, competitive people, compared to a community college which has open admissions and where anyone can go. You know, the educational experience at Harvard or Yale is generally considered more intense and more profitable for people really interested in their subjects than studying the same kind of subjects at a community college where you're surrounded by people who may not really want to be there or aren't really that committed. And, you know, the virtue of a sect is that you have that kind of experience. The problem with it is that it does create tensions and can create a stigma for the people that are involved with it in the larger society, which can hurt their ability to act as middle-class agents or agents in the larger society.
Do you see the OTO moving away? And if so, how is the OTO currently moving away from the sect mentality to a church mentality?
Well, this is one of the things that I think the people interested in this within the community are looking to explore. one of the most interesting examples I can think of is that in the Gnostic Mass, Crowley very explicitly says that no one who is not going to take communion or communicate should be present at the Mass. That is sort of a sect-like restriction. It seems simple, but it's a discipline where if you're not going to take communion, you shouldn't be showing up at the service. He says that very explicitly. The current OTO has changed that rule and says it's up to you whether you take communion or not. You can attend Mass, but you don't have to take communion. Now, even just changing that rule in that little degree points towards a movement away from sect and towards church. You know, they're trying to eliminate the weird little discipline details that distinguish a sect from a church.
Can you give some other examples?
Well, I would have anyone go through some of the founding OTO documents that Crowley wrote and see whether or not they have provisions that look sect-like or church-like. And in nearly every instance, something that looks like a sect has been dropped in favor of something that looks more like a church. You know, for example, Crowley said the OTO is supposed to set up homes for unwed mothers. There are churches and groups that do that now, but they tend to have some tension with the rest of society. That is a program that the OTO is not even thinking of adopting now. It's dropped without any notice whatsoever. Some other examples are, you know, the financial structure of the organization, how we're supposed to support the leaders. All of that stuff looks very sect-like to me, does not look very church-like, and all of that stuff has been dropped. Look at the disciplines, for example, for the Electoral College and the OTO. You have to excel at sports. You have to be trained in philosophy. There's certain, you know, very explicit kinds of criteria. Those have been dropped. There's, you know, as we know, there have been other criteria too. I mean, I'm very disappointed in the fact that many of the EGC clergy don't seem very well educated in Gnosticism or, you know, even Thelema and the OTO that much. Well, if we were to make it harder for people to be in the clergy, that would be more sect-like by making it easier or relatively sort of, you know, bureaucratic standard process, which, you know, isn't that all that tough and doesn't have really strict requirements. It's more church-like.
Well, what are the benefits of being church-like?
Well, you don't have the stigma you have of being in a sect. You know, if you're an Episcopalian, that doesn't influence people think weirdly of you or not. You know, if you're a Muni or in the Krishnas, that's going to impact on your life in the larger world in significant ways. It carries a stigma. Even being a very Orthodox, you know, Jewish person, you're going to wear a yarmulke, you're going to have side curls, you may have a beard if you're a man. These are, you know, distinguishing characteristics which can be stigmatizing. And the virtue of people engaged in those communities is that they don't have to put up with half-hearted moochers and freeloaders. The people that are surrounding them in those communities are extremely dedicated. They'd have to be in order to take on that kind of stigma. Whereas in churches, you're going to have a lot of people who, yeah, maybe they're into it, maybe they're not. And your experience won't be as intense.
What does class have to do with this?
Well, you know, one of the things that classic sociologists have always looked at, and this isn't Inokone, but the people that he references and studies, that they see a transition from sect to church happening when middle-class people or upper-class people take over the sect, and because they're uncomfortable with the stigma, turn it into a church. And there's a progress from sect to church that you can chart in many instances. And one of the things I was speaking about with you earlier today was, you know, the debate between David Hume and Adam Smith. And David Hume references these horrible little cults and sects of his time, which he sees as being really insidious and really problematic. And they're groups like the Presbyterians and the Quakers, which today, while they may have started as troublesome sects with high degrees of tension with the surrounding community, are now, you know, bastions of rectitude and are no more cult-like than any other Protestant denomination. So it's kind of funny to see in David Hume's writing this evidence of this transition from sect to church. And I think the rise of the middle-class Thelemite in the 90s, the middle-class people taking over a lot of the Thelemic organizations, leads them to be uncomfortable with the sect approach and to be more comfortable with the church approach, and therefore they work to alter the organization away from the sect model and towards the church model. So middle-class people are the ones with the most to lose in a sect, because they would have to give up their middle-class power, their middle-class prestige, their power as good bourgeois agents. So consequently, it's in their best interest from a class perspective to move the group away from a sect.
It seems kind of odd to me that a Thelemite would try to align themselves with the norms of society when Thelema seems in general to be contrary to the majority of the norms of society. So doesn't that create an internal conflict where the whole Thelemic system is kind of sect-like, but if you take aspects of it and make it more church-like, you have an internal conflict?
Oh, I think that contradiction is getting, you know, more and more obvious and is more and more problematic. And I think a lot of people think that they're going to get prestige and get respect by making the organization more respectable-looking, i.e. more church-like. And I think others of us are, you know, saying that that's not important. We're not looking for this outside respect. We will, you know, be perfectly happy, you know, avoiding that sort of, you know, caving into societal expectations. But I think you also have to look at the way most people approach Thelema is from a very conflicted position in the first place. You know, I basically think that there is a huge amount of tension between Thelema and secular humanism. That's not something most of the people in the OTO, to me, seem willing to concede, and they get very hostile when you suggest that there are conflicts between standard secular humanism and Thelema. Well, then the question is, isn't Thelema redundant if we already have secular humanism? What's the point of it? And that sort of question points to, I think, the conflicts people have about Crowley's teaching and about Thelema. They like aspects of it, they don't like others, and they have a hard time separating out the stuff they like from the stuff they don't like. And that conflict is a conflict you see as people struggle with the idea of moving the group from sect to church. You know, the other thing, and I've talked about this recently too, is somebody made a famous comment once, I'm not quite sure who it is, we can probably look it up online, when they said that America is the only country in the world that passed from a period of barbarism to a period of decadence without an intervening period of civilization. Well, I often, you know, this is a witty comment, and I often think that the OTO is kind of in an analogous situation. It passes from a period of primitivism where you have Crowley on the beach at Kefalu trying to get a goat to have sex with Leia Hersig, and then when it doesn't, sacrificing it, which is, you know, about as extreme and sect-like as you can come up with,
right,
to this sort of Thelemic Unitarianism that a lot of the current OTO leaders seem really comfortable with and seem to want to promulgate. So where's the intervening period between, you know, the intensity of this experience on the beach, which is shocking and very sect-like, to this very bland, very non-threatening, very mainstream sort of approach? And they're trying to skip a step. I think they're trying to skip the sect step where, you know, a lot of these issues become solidified. I think they want to move it to a church without having have to pass through a sect stage.
Well, what is the result?
Well, I think the result is dysfunctional. I mean, I think this is where the organization runs into a lot of its problems. And in the model of the OTO, which they're trying to adapt in a lot of ways, is not a church model. It's a sect model. Well, what happens when people with church values try to run a sect model? You know, they run into conflicts. You know, I've pointed this out before, that in other circumstances, what if you have a bunch of Quakers trying to run the Roman Catholic Church? The Roman Catholic Church's structure is set up to reflect Roman Catholic values of hierarchy, of, you know, the Pope's infallibility, the difference between the clergy and the congregation. To have a Quaker who doesn't believe in any of those things try to operate that kind of system is just going to create massive problems. Well, in a lot of ways, we see an analogous problem with the OTO. We have people with essentially Quaker secular humanist values trying to run a structure that is hierarchical and in opposition to all of those values and beliefs. So you're going to have a conflict there. And, you know, some people have said, well, we need to change the structure of the order. Crowley was wrong, and we need to alter the OTO around. But as soon as they try to do that, then they run into even more problems because none of them have the authority and the magical ability and understanding and wisdom and prestige that Crowley did. So
is there conflict really with Crowley, or is it a conflict with the sect that they don't want to sacrifice their prestige or placement in society, or they're already on the fringes of society and they want to move closer to the center, not farther out from the center?
I think that's definitely a big issue. I think a lot of people feel that progress for them is going to be making themselves more middle class, not less. So adopting a sect's beliefs hinder their movement into a more secure position within the middle class. that's definitely going to be an issue. But I think a lot of times the very basic issue is a conflict in values between the values they were raised with and their humanism and what Crowley presents, which is not at all in keeping with that. So, you know, what do they do? What happens when that conflict occurs? And, you know, what I find fascinating is the people who are willing to examine this and the people who aren't. I mean, you know, it's that old advertising slogan, let's, you know, run this flag up and see who salutes. You know, we can look at who wants to really engage in looking and studying at these kind of problems and issues and the people who just try to ignore it and hope that it'll go away. You know, I think you need a certain, you know, kind of interest in order to be engaged with looking at these very serious, very debilitating kinds of problems. And I'm disappointed that more of the leaders aren't leading us by exploring these kinds of issues and confronting them honestly. In fact, I think it's significant that a lot of them are obviously trying to avoid it.
Well, that's all the time that we have for this program. Maybe on the next one we can continue exploring this. It's a fascinating topic. On the Thelema Coast to Coast website, I'll be putting a link to all of Inacone's documents so that people can go and download them and read them for themselves and make some decisions for themselves. And hopefully by the next time we speak about this, some people will have listened and be better familiar with the material.
I hope that that's the case. I think the material is really important and that it rewards close and careful study and discussion.
Thanks again for being on this show, and I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, thank you. 93.
93.
Well, that's all I have for this show. I appreciate you listening to this fifth podcast. Please keep the comments and suggestions coming. Also note that I will try to respond to all emails, but there are times when due to my schedule that the responses will be delayed. I hope you understand. As always, the Thelema Coast to Coast website, www.thelemacoast2coast.com, that's coast, T-O, coast, will have show notes, links, and program descriptions. You can also listen to the podcast right from the website. Despite its name, the podcast file can be played on any computer or any music player that supports MP3 or even burned to a CD and listened to on a standard CD player. Please spread the word about the podcast, write about it on your blog, post links on your site. I have seen that many people are already doing this, and I appreciate the support and the vote of confidence. Word of mouth is always the best advertising. Again, thanks for listening to the podcast, and I hope you stick around for the next. Love is the law, love under will. I'm gonna go get some more.
I'm going to go to the hospital.